Hi, this is The Intern Whisperer. So my name is Isabella Johnston, and on our show, we always talk about the future of work and innovation. And today's guest is Sean Snaith, PhD. He is the director of the University of Central Florida's Institute for Economic Forecasting and a nationally recognized economist in the field of business and economic forecasting. He is a sought-after speaker known for engaging and humorous presentations. He's earned praise from one business editor for having an uncanny knack for making economics not only understandable, but interesting. And you will see, he will do stand-up comedy for us, I'm quite sure, except he's sitting down. So, Sean, welcome to the show.
Thank you for having me.
I'm so happy to have you here. So before we started, I asked you, what are the five words that describe you and why those five words? So I'll kick it off with tall. I'm 5'2". You're a giant to me. So how tall are you?
6'5", yeah.
So, whoa, that is super tall.
Yeah, I could reach the top shelf. Let me just tell you that.
Yeah, yeah. Everybody's going, hey, could you get this down for me in the grocery store?
That's been my experience on many occasions, actually. So I'm happy to do it. Yeah. Why not?
Yeah. analytical. Why analytical?
I'm just, you know, sort of a numbers guy, and I like to think critically about things. And one of the words that I think I mentioned was that I'm also skeptical. And so, you know, I want to come to my own conclusions about things. I want to see the evidence. I want to interpret. I don't want someone to tell me what this means. Right? Because if you're telling me something, then it's a story.
Mm-hmm.
Unless I can see upon which, you know, you're building this story and confirm and verify it, then it's just a story. And that's okay if, you know, you're Stephen King and it's fiction. But, if it's something nonfiction, then, you know, I like to think things through myself. I'm not saying I know everything, and I'm not saying the story you're telling me is necessarily wrong, but, you know, I want to see the data upon which I want to see the analysis that led you to say these things. And then I can analyze it myself and either concur or disagree.
I like that answer. And so you pulled that analytic and skeptical right in together. Do you approach that in everything that you do in your life, or is that just in things that relate to economics?
Well, it's everything, I think. I mean, even as a child, I can just remember, you know, encountering situations or being told things, and then just in my head, you know, thinking, yeah, that doesn't add up. Now, that doesn't add up. And maybe I didn't have the tools or the knowledge to kind of know why it didn't add up, but there was just something. Mm-hmm. Yeah, that skeptic inside of me that needed the tools to be able to apply that skepticism a little more surgically. Mm-hmm. But maybe people take skeptic as I don't know if there's a negative connotation floating around it, like, it, you know, he's a skeptic, you know, that's like being a Debbie Downer, you know.
Yes.
He just whatever you say, he won't believe it. Well, that's not true. But like I said, I do like to come to my own conclusion. I do like to have the facts that I can, you know, digest and process. And, you know, I'll listen to your story, but I'm not going to just, you know, swallow it hook, line, and sinker.
Mm-hmm. So your last word that you had mentioned was funny. Where did the funny come in? Because you have these things about analytics and skeptical and then funny. I know we didn't cover that word. I'm going to go back to that one and just reel it in, because I think I've been watching you and listening to you for a while, and I think you're hysterically funny.
I don't take compliments very well. That's a big flaw of mine, but I am. I have a good sense of humor. I think I'm fairly quick-witted. I've had a lifelong ability to make people laugh, you know, either at me or with me. It doesn't matter. I think a lot of who we are is absolutely genetic. So a funny bone, or there's some mutation of this particular gene that happened to me in the womb. I don't know. But also, I grew up in an Irish family, and tongues were sharp, and it was almost a survival skill, to be quick-witted and to be able to take a joke. Importantly, make a joke, and maybe more importantly, be able to take a joke. So I find myself, as often as I'm making a joke, being the butt of the joke, yeah. Which to me is equally funny and enjoyable.
Wow. Well, that's good. I went to this event at Dr. Phillips, and it was called Bored Teachers, B-O-R-E-D. Mm. And this all started from COVID, when the teachers were going, well, what are we going to do? And so it's everybody. It's K through 12 and it's higher ed. And they get in and they tell the funniest darn stories. And because I never laughed so hard in my whole life, because everything that they said, I taught middle and high school and then in higher ed. I'm sure you have so many hundreds of stories that you could tell, you know, that dealing with students, just dealing with people in general in education. But it was really, really funny. I suggest that you check it out. They are going to have an audition in June. I'll send you the link, because I think you could go and audition, and then you get on the road and you're doing like comedy, stand-up comedy.
Well, here's the thing. So people that, you know, like yourself, who have heard me speak and say, wow, this guy's really funny. I understand that that perception and my reputation as being a sort of humorous and funny speaker is built entirely on low expectations. there's an economist on the agenda, and I see this in individual people's reaction. I meet somebody in a social setting. What do you do? Oh, I'm a professor. Oh, wow. Yeah. What do you teach? Economics. Oh, then you just see a little piece of them die, a little bit of the light goes out in their eye. So I think someone comes in and they have maybe a preconception of what an economic speaker is going to be like. And, I just clear that bar by an inch or two. And, suddenly it's like, wow, what a funny economist. But again, it's personality, I think, in terms of that. And I just happen to be an economist. And when it comes to public speaking, I honed, I guess, most of those skills that, when I'm out speaking to a general audience in the classroom. You've got, by and large, a room filled with 18 to 22-year-olds who are thinking about all those things that you think about when you're 18 to 22. And it's tough to focus on, GDP accounting when you're 18 to 22. Engaging the class and keeping them focused and breaking it up with humor, whatever it takes to allow them to refocus, and instead of just droning on, I always felt that onus was on me. And I've had colleagues that are just the opposite. They're sort of, I'm a fount of knowledge, and if they choose not to drink from me, that's their problem. But I always saw the student as sort of a customer. It's my job to help them learn these things. It's just sort of worked well and transcended, the campus into the real world when it comes to just trying to keep people engaged and listening.
Mm. Do you have a favorite movie that is built around education by any chance? I kind of see you as a Robin Williams going, standing on the desk. My captain.
I've never been a big sort of physical humor type person, or, a prop guy. I'm not really the Carrot Top type humorist, but it more just a wry sort of plays on words. I mean, sometimes I will put, I do enjoy a little, Photoshop type based humor, but a movie around education.
Gosh, there was like Lean on Me. There was all of these different movies that came out. I guess it was probably in the 80s or 90s, you know, and they were just.
Well, maybe The Breakfast Club. How's that? You weren't expecting that answer.
Oh, no. But that one was really good. That's classic.
Yeah, that is a classic. It's not really about education. It's about detention. And, you know, I've done my time there as well.
Yeah, that is true. All right. So you, where did you go to school and how did you end up to where you are now? What was that journey like, that career path? When did you decide economics?
Well, I think the seeds were sown, you know, in my early, early life as a child. I grew up in Pittsburgh, Pennsylvania, in poverty. And I always say American poverty, mm-hmm. because I've lived overseas in developing countries, and what we call poverty and what I, you know, lamented my, you know, life of back then, I realized as an adult that there's 6 billion people that would have killed to live that life. But, so I was poor, you know, welfare, the whole thing, food stamps, where they were actually little stamps you had to rip out of a book and pay with them at the grocery store, in Pittsburgh, Pennsylvania. And so this was also, you know, this was during the 1970s that I was, you know, a child. And the steel industry, which had long, you know, been the backbone of Pittsburgh's economy, was crumbling. You know, they didn't call it globalism then, but that's in fact what it was. You know, there was foreign producers that were producing steel more efficiently, which means less expensively. And so these mills started to close down. So, you know, the entire town was sort of going through, a deep recession. Because of that. And there were other things that happened during the 1970s. I mean, we had, you know, very high inflation for several years of, you know, double digits or higher. You know, there was gasoline rationing, odd even license plates because of oil embargoes in the Middle East that cut off the oil supply. So there was a lot of things happening in the economy that I just couldn't wrap my head around. And I remember, you know, asking my mother, who, you know, went to high school, but, you know, seeing the news and these steel workers and that they, you know, were unemployed, and I couldn't, you know, I said, well, if they want to work, why won't they just let them work? And I remember asking that question. Mm-hmm. And so I think that's where the seeds of going into economics, and because I didn't, you know, I was on sort of a pre-med track when I started undergrad, but it was a liberal arts school and you had to take a wide variety of courses, one of which was a writing seminar in macroeconomics. And so lo and behold, all these sort of mystical terms and phenomena that you know were befuddling to me as a child were being explained, and I started to understand, and that I think those seeds of my childhood germinated once I took that class. And of course, you know, it ruined my life. I could have been a real doctor had that not happened. But no, I was had an interest, and that class just kind of let it loose. And here I am today, still sort of learning and fascinated by it all.
So I went to school and I got an MBA, and one of the classes, and I didn't have any exposure to it because I was an English major. And I heard the concept of an invisible hand in economics. I went, what is this? Why don't you explain it to our listeners?
Sure. So the invisible hand was how an economist by the name of Adam Smith described what we teach today as just basically the market mechanism. And markets consist of supply and demand. And it's a very basic and fundamental model and tool And when I'm teaching students in an introductory classes, if you don't remember anything, you don't, you know, learn anything, learn this.
Mm-hmm.
Because Milton Friedman, late economist, Nobel Prize winner, once commented that virtually all problems in economics boil down to supply and demand. The invisible hand is just the notion that markets, which are these arrangements by which buyers and sellers come together, and it might be a market, in the town square, a farmer's market, it might be a Walmart, it might be a, a supermarket, it might be a financial market, it may be an online auction, but some mechanism by which buyers and sellers come together to make exchange. And when there's changes within the market, like, for example, there's an increase in population in Central Florida because of COVID, because of migration from Puerto Rico, whatever, that's going to change demand for certain things in the region, say housing. So when the market's disturbed, then the price, the equilibrium price in the market is going to have to adjust. And the invisible hand is this notion that the price adjusts without any individual person deciding, without some committee getting together and saying, yes, we must adjust this price, without some Politburo or some department of X, Y, or Z setting that price. The market guides it to this new equilibrium price. And it was described as an invisible hand. It just works. It's all these individuals are getting together, driven by their own individual objectives, and they're interacting in a way. And this interaction guides the market to the price that, for the moment, is the equilibrium price. Nobody decided, hey, let's start raising housing prices in Central Florida. Let's raise house prices 20% a year for the next 2 years. Nobody made that decision, but that's what happened. That's where the market was guided. And so this was my comment about more people coming into the area, raising demand for things like housing. And so the price of housing goes up. It wasn't decided by anyway, but it was this invisible hand that guided us there.
Mm. I thought that was just, that was a really good definition, and thanks for explaining it. I find that whenever I was teaching in higher ed, I had to give scenarios that were relatable to them, because sometimes the students, they just didn't get it. So I might have to say, so fingernail polish, let's talk about this, or beer, like something that they could relate to. So then they'd go, oh, okay, I understand, because there will be some that it just flies over their head still.
Well, that's right. And, that's part of engaging any audiences, you can talk. And even my description there, I wouldn't put that on a top 1000 list. I think it's better with a chalkboard when you're talking about markets and showing how it works. But, nonetheless, yeah, if you can tie it into somebody's own sphere of existence, then it hits home. If you start talking about, derivatives markets, futures or options, and to someone that has no, maybe the best explanation ever, but it's moot because the person just simply can't connect. So, yeah, I mean, people know, hey, eggs were $14 a dozen. That's nuts. Why did that happen? Did someone just decide to punish omelet lovers? No, here's what happened. Supply mm-hmm. and demand can give us the answer there.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, really? $14.99? Wow, a dozen? I did not see that one. I missed it.
Well, this was a while back, and these were, even just your basic eggs were $9 a dozen.
Not the organic.
Yeah, but yeah, the 14, I saw the 14, but those were sort of free range organic, free love, chickens that got massages every day. So those were, gourmet eggs, but still, the price of which even the basic eggs had gone up was something that was, I think, shocking to people, but certainly something that was easily explained in the context of this small model called supply and demand.
So I went to a UCF, Meet the Dean event that was here in Orlando last month, and that's where you were speaking. And I was just thrilled to be able to be there. I missed the ones that the county used to put on when we used to go down to the convention center, but I digress. You were talking about what 2024 was going to look like. What do you think it's going to look like here now for us, in Florida and in the country and in the world? What do you think?
Yeah, I mean, globally, you're seeing some parts of the world. I think the United Kingdom probably is currently in a recession. You're seeing some problems in China. But generally speaking, a lot of places are trying to come out of the COVID-19 driven disruptions and policies that were so, I keep going back to the word violent, because the way it disrupted the economy and the way money was spent and interest rates were driven to zero just created all this tumultuousness. And we're still, trying to get out of these rapids in some way and into a little more normal water. 2024, I think we're going to see a slowing down, certainly. I think that consumers in the United States have faced 2.5 years of what economists call declining real wages and salaries. What does real wages mean, a real salary? Well, your dollar, your paycheck may have gone up. Your hourly wage may have gone up the past couple of years. But what that money can purchase has actually gone down. So you have more dollars in your account, but what those dollars can purchase is less than what they would have been able to purchase, say, 2.5 years ago before this inflation had taken its hold on the economy. And that is wearing on consumers. We came out of the pandemic, we were locked down, locked up, couldn't travel, couldn't shop unless it was a so-called, essential business. Many people got big checks from the government during this time. And, we came out of, once the lockdowns ended, the economy roared to life. And then we started. That was sort of, the roller coaster, right? We went down, the decision was made to shut down the economy. That was that first big drop in the roller coaster. And then when we opened up, the economy just started rocketing back up again. But now we're kind of past all that. All that savings that was built up during the COVID lockdowns and the first year and a half of this episode has been exhausted. And now people get to the end of the month and that paycheck does not cover everything that they need to purchase. Rents have gone up substantially. The price of automobiles has gone up. Interest rates have gone up. So, if you're borrowing to buy any of these things, your mortgage payment each month has gone up significantly. Your car payment, electricity, energy prices have gone up substantially, post COVID. And people, I think many households get to the end of the month, as I said, and there's a gap, there's a hole in their budget that I think many are turning toward or filling by turning towards credit cards. Because over the same 2 years that inflation has been growing faster than our incomes, the balances on credit cards have been rising. This is not a coincidence in this case. And in this case, I think there's some causation that goes along with this correlation. And so you get to the end of the month, you've had to pay this rent that might've gone up $300 a month, but now your kids need shoes. Well, you're going to get the shoes, but you put it on a credit card. Mm-hmm. And so those credit card balances are now well over $1 trillion. Interest rates on credit cards are now well into the 20%. So that means your minimum monthly payment, as they love to tell you, has gone up significantly as well. And I think that's going to cause households to sort of, pull back on the spending a little bit as we go through 2024. The reason I don't necessarily think a recession is definitively going to occur is that people have jobs by and large. The labor market is very strong. And I think that's allowing people, you know, you're going underwater a little bit because your paycheck, you know, doesn't make ends meet, but you get another paycheck next month and you can come up for some air again. It's when people start losing jobs and losing paychecks that you really start to see a bigger impact on spending and on the economy as a whole. So I guess the too long didn't listen version of what's going to happen in 2024 is I think we're going to see a slowdown of the economy. I think the risk of a recession is certainly still elevated. But we're still trying to shake off the pernicious effects of, you know, very bad, in my opinion, policy response to COVID-19.
Yeah, I don't know if it's really, I've seen people making some better decisions, but I still see them spending in areas that kind of surprise me, extravagancies, you know, like what is, you know, Apple Pro, like why should we go and get the Apple Vision? And that's like $4,000, $6,000? It was ridiculous. And I went, wow, those are people that have money to burn.
Well, sure. And I mean, again, you know, the experience varies widely across income levels. I mean, you know, your average, person, I don't think is rushing out buying these $4,000 goggles that I'm not sure do a whole heck of a lot in terms of contributing to your life other than, oh, new tech, must try. You know, there are people who are like that, right? Yeah. Something new, you know, whatever they're into, they'll rush out. Oh, here's the latest, Air Jordans. Got to have them. You know, it's just my thing. It's my jam. But you know, looking in the big picture sense, you know, people are, like I said, those credit card balances are up. The interest rates on those credit cards are up. You can't keep, you know, you got to start paring down in those instances. And it's, again, not that people aren't going to be spending. I just think they're not going to be spending with the same,
cavalier, I would call it.
Just the velocity, just the amount. I mean, I just think, you know, maybe we're going to cut down on some of these, you know, niceties. I mean, you've got to have a place to live, right?
Right.
You need to eat. Now, do you need to eat out at a restaurant four times a week? Well, no, you don't. You know, you need transportation, you know, you need heat and light, you know, so there are things that you can't really cut down on. It's these other low hanging fruits that I think people will pull back on. And some of that, you know, maybe travel and tourism, you know, we may see a bit of a slowing here in Central Florida, the tourism growth. Things that can't go on forever don't.
Mm-hmm.
You can't continue to use credit cards to patch budget shortfalls. I mean, the government can do this, but you and I cannot.
No, they do not let us do that. So what you're explaining, just so our listeners understand, is the difference between a need and a want. And you have to really sit down and go, is this a need? Do I need to have a house that's over in the 32789 Winter Park, or do I need to have a house that I can actually afford to maintain and enjoy? Because not everybody can live in the areas that they may want, but they can still have a very good life.
Well, you know, in introductory economics, we really, in the absolute, underpinning of the entire discipline is that people, our wants are unlimited.
Oh, yeah.
We always want something.
Mm-hmm.
Oh, my private jet's too small. I want a bigger one. Mm-hmm. You know, I want more vacation. I want to go to, you know, fancier hotel. I want better, you know, cuts of meat. I want organic produce. I want, but the resources to meet these wants are limited. So you have unlimited wants running into limited resources. And out of that collision, economics has been born. And the decisions, what, you know, decisions have to be made when wants are unlimited and the resources to meet those wants are scarce. And that is, in a nutshell, in the broadest definition, what economics is, explaining those choices.
Mm-hmm. Yep, I get it. So we're going to change direction a little bit. Who are some of your favorite thought leaders and why? Doesn't have to be in economics, can be anything.
What if it is in economics? Then I'm going to look like, you know, Bobby Boring.
No,
thought leaders. I'm an independent thinker. I mean, I think, like I said, this is going back to my liberal arts stuff. I mean, I think philosophy is very interesting, and to see the evolution of that and, you know, understand, you know, different schools there. But, you know, in terms of my life on a more daily basis, I think Thomas Sowell is an excellent economist. I think, I don't know if he's retired or not, but I think if he's not, he's at Stanford University. And I think he is a sort of the intellectual heir to another economist that, you know, I always, you know, really admire, who was Milton Friedman. You know, both these gentlemen have, you know, just a very sober, cut to the chase. This is, you know, this is economics. This is the reality. And you know, I will listen to, if I see a clip of Sowell talking, I'll watch it. Mm-hmm. You know, just to hear the guy's opinion on different things. So, yeah. I mean, I would say those two probably, I think, are thought leader. I think everybody should listen to them. I mean, I think that's just, there's some fundamental truths that these gentlemen are able to explain that if everybody understood, I think a lot of the problems that vex our society and culture might tend to melt away.
Mm. That's good to know. I'm going to go look them up. I don't know if they have a podcast, but I'll go listen. I'll look for it first. Hmm. What is a hard lesson that you experienced that gave you a deeper understanding of empathy for others? Since you grew up poor, I kind of think that you probably have a good answer.
Yeah. I mean, let's see. I don't know when I got out of poverty. I mean, I guess technically, you know, not until I finished my PhD, but in terms of income levels. But no, I mean, throughout my childhood, you know, understanding, you know, not having things. And yeah, we are, you know, as you were saying a moment or two ago, you know, I want, you know, you're kind of bombarded with consumerism, right? And it's, you know, it's just, and so for me, it was like, oh, I'm watching cartoons on Saturday morning. That's when they showed the kids cartoons. It was just that day and, you know, for the morning time. But they had commercials for all these, you know, sugary cereals that, you know, look so delicious, but I just couldn't afford them. My family couldn't afford them, didn't have that. Seeing my mother struggle, working very, hard labor type jobs for very little money, and struggling to pay bills and, you know, keep us housed. I think when you go through that, it definitely changes you, right? It shapes you. You can't escape that experience. And so, yes, I think I am more empathetic because of it. I know that people don't have the life I have, but I also know what it is to struggle. Mm-hmm. As I mentioned, you know, having lived in developing countries for several years, I've seen what really true struggle is. In terms of, you know, survival, you know, levels of struggles, not just, oh, I didn't get the latest, iPhone. I still have the 13 and all my friends have the 15, you know.
Yeah.
I don't know why we're bashing Apple products here, but anyway.
Two
have come up. Yeah, I've got an iPhone myself. I'm very empathetic, and I'm also I understand that in those households, and I started earning money, in ways I wouldn't talk about, but also just doing jobs that whatever I could get, around the age of 8 or 9. And I knew that, that extra $20 bill that came into the house meant the difference between me and my siblings having regular milk or having to drink powdered milk.
Mm.
And if you've not had powdered milk, the difference between powdered milk and regular milk is substantial.
Yeah.
I mean, the quality of life improvement that I was able to engineer by working early and bringing in just even a little bit of money to go from powdered milk to regular milk was phenomenal. And so I know that, there are households that are like that, that people are struggling and that's how they work. And every buck that can come in is a buck that makes them better off. And so when I hear people, demanding, we need this level of a minimum wage, because we got to help these people. I know, because I'm an economist, and I also know because I lived in a household like that, that wherever these people's hearts are and their heads, they're going to be hurting families like the one I grew up in, because some of these people, when you raise the minimum wage above the market wage, when you go against the invisible hand,
mm-hmm.
people will lose their jobs or they'll get their hours reduced. And young kids like myself, who might have been able to get a job after school to contribute to the family and upgrade from powdered milk to regular milk, can't get that job because a skillless 15-year-old is not going to be paid $25 to sweep a floor.
No, they're not.
So, yeah. So in arguing against these kind of minimum wage hikes, I sound like I don't have empathy. But it comes from the deepest form of empathy.
Right.
And I think a lot of the people that argue for them are people that have no clue.
Yeah, they haven't lived it.
They haven't lived it.
Yeah, because what ends up happening is that we get more innovation in places where, gosh, I can walk through any restaurant and just order and I wouldn't even have to deal with a person. Now, how many people just lost a job?
Right. And now some of that's technology and some of that would.
But.
However, when you artificially raise wages, you will accelerate that process, and it has accelerated. I mean, there is a convenience store gas station that I guess it's the regular place I get gas. They had shut down. I went in one night and I wanted to go inside after getting a gas, and it was 6 p.m. on a weeknight. The doors were locked because they said we have staff shortages. Now that same place has self-checkout lines inside to help deal with that.
See, that's my point. Yeah.
So again, you're going back to understanding just fundamentals and basics of economics would inform some of these policies in a way that, I think we could make smarter decisions.
Yeah, I don't think that the whole picture is being evaluated. We're going to take a moment and acknowledge our sponsor. We will be right back.
The Intern Whisperer is brought to you by Cat 5 Studios, who help you create games and videos for your training and marketing needs that are out of this world. Visit Cat 5 Studios for more information to learn how Cat 5 Studios can help your business. Thank you, Cat 5 Studios.
Okay, and we're back to the second half of the show, and I just love the conversation that we were having about how technology, raising wages, all different types of it sounds like it's good, but it doesn't always take in the whole picture. Just because we can doesn't mean we should. That type of philosophy, just because we can make something faster, more efficient, Who is being hurt by that? Just because we are raising wages, who's being hurt by that? And I think you raise a really valid point to the conversation of like, well, what about those that are never going to be a software engineer? And what about those that greet you at Walmart just to say hi and they're in the wheelchair? Where are these people or the immigrants that come to our country that are doctors that are driving Lyft? Like, where are all of these people being relegated into society because of things that they can't get? They can't go get a license to be a doctor in this country because they'd have to start all over again, right? All of these different things.
Yeah. Well, you know, I mean, these are sort of cartelish behavior, right? You know, the American Medical Association doesn't necessarily want the competition to come in. And it's not just doctors, right? I mean, in some places it might be, you know, you can't be a barber, you know, you have to go back and go through that training again. So, you know, some of it is to keep out competition and thereby, you know, keep wages from falling. So those, you know, those people that, you know, may have been credentialed in another, you know, another country can't carry that over. And I'm not saying, you know, maybe the credentialing is not up to the standard that we expect here in the United States, but there's probably some middle ground that would allow these people, you know, to transition or to, you know, some intermediate step instead of, you know, going back down, you know, to the starting line and doing the whole thing again, you know. And, you know, I think there's been some loosening of this, particularly, you know, we're talking medical field for no good reason, but for, you know, in nursing, there's such a tremendous shortage of nurses. So, you know, I think maybe the restrictions there in terms of, you know, migrants being able to work in that field is not as great as, you know, as in some others, but just, you know, that's a response to, we just don't have enough, you know, with an aging population and, you know, the need for medical care and medical services just continues to grow, you know, with each passing day. So, but yeah, you know, it's again, and, you know, we talked about this is kind of, I don't even know how you're going to label this talk, because it's like sort of Snaith's stream of consciousness. But, you know, these people that come in, you know, migrants, you know, they come here to, again, for the dream that this country offers that just simply is not available, you know, in most countries around the world. You know, if I was, you know, in the circumstances I was in a child and I was, you know, not in Pittsburgh, Pennsylvania, but I was in Cairo, Egypt, it's highly unlikely I would have ever escaped those, the bonds, the shackles of poverty. Here, you know, my mother struggled mightily. She did everything she could, you know, to give her kids a chance. And a lot of these migrants are that way as well. You know, they're willing to work, drive an Uber and Lyft, because it's for the, you know, it's for their children, it's for their grandchildren, to give them the opportunity. So, you know, that's part of the, you know, story of all migrants, I think, in this country. You know, many people came here and they, you know, did not have great jobs. You know, they worked very hard and in very poor conditions. But, you know, it was for the family. So,
was your, since you've always mentioned your mom, do you didn't have a dad in the home? So
For a while, I think I was, I don't know, 6 or 7, and just kind of went the way of the buffalo, as they say.
Oh, I see. So yeah, that would have been really, really hard because at the time, I'm sure women, they hardly made any money, and trying to raise, I don't know how many kids were in the family.
3 at the time, yeah.
Yeah, that's a lot, and she's doing the best she can. So, you know, seeing her kids grow up and be college graduates, I'm sure she was extremely proud at that time and still is.
Well, remember when I said I was pre-med when I started college?
Yeah, yeah.
No, I'm just kidding. Of course she's proud, and I'm grateful for everything that she did. And you know, that's why I exist, so that my kids can, you know, take the steps necessary, you
Yeah.
know, on my back.
Yeah, definitely. So what do you think 2030 is going to look like when we talk about this, you know, as it relates to the world, the industries, and just jobs in general? What do you think?
Well, I mean, well, obviously AI is the belle of the ball right now in terms of you know, investing and prognostication about the future, good and bad. And 6 years, you know, that's not a huge amount of time, right? I mean, I don't think in
No.
2030 we're gonna look back and say, whoa, you know, look how primitive 2024 was. You know, I think this progress will advance. I see, and I'm not an expert in these areas, either of these areas, but I see the AI and the hullabaloo and the discussion of the disruptive nature of it and what it's going to do very similar to the discussion of robotics when robotics came onto the scene and was starting to show up in manufacturing, and you know, everyone was going to have their own robot, you know, at home to help them. Yeah. All these kind of crazy things about how robots were just going to take over and change everything and take everybody's job. Well, that didn't materialize. You know, the only robot I have is the Zumba vacuum cleaner, and I can't run it because it scares my dog. So my robot's useless. But what happened with robots is, sure, was there some people that lost their jobs? You know, the person that was hand tightening screws on an assembly line could be replaced by a robot that tightened those screws and, you know, didn't get carpal tunnel syndrome, could work, you know, 18 hours a day. But there was also workers that became more productive because they had a robot beside them, helping them to, you know, place the windshield into the car and thereby do it more quickly and more efficiently, and thereby raise their value as an employee. And then there's a whole host of other jobs that were created, building the robots, programming the robots, maintaining the robots. So that, you know, it's part of this creative destruction that you see in market economies. I mean, new industries, new products, new services come out. You know, some have a bigger impact than others, but they all have some degree of disruption, you know, involved. I mean, there were people one day who made it, I'm sure made a good living and had a career in installing and repairing payphones around this country. Now, they lost their jobs. You know, are you willing to give up your iPhone to, you know, so they can go back? And were you willing to have to stop? Get out of your car, put a quarter in to make a phone call? Of course
No.
not. And so with AI, you know, I feel some of the same, you know, hysteria, both about the good and the bad of it. And you know, I think it will impact, certainly. It will cause some jobs to go away. I think it will result in jobs we can't even think of. At this very moment, I think it will make people in some ways more productive. And it's fairly new as well, right? And this notion of like there's one giant brain, like one all-encompassing piece of artificial intelligence that's just gonna, I don't know, almost a, you know, a god or goddess-like entity. I'm not sure that that's going to play out that way. I mean, I think, and again, I'm no expert, and an AI person might be listening to this thinking this is the stupidest person I've ever listened to. But, you know, I would think that like you could have, I don't know, a custom made or your own AI that was like that knew, how Isabella wrote, that knew how Isabella spoke, that could do some things for Isabella and learn from, you know, her life or her body of work and, you know, be like a little extension of yourself.
Yeah.
I don't know, but, you know, it's fun to think of. I think mischief, of course, is always a possibility. You know, I don't want to go the whole Skynet Terminator route, you know, of robots that are, you know, become self-aware and, you know, program themselves and make changes to programs. But, you know, things like, I mean, there is in all of this some Orwellian sort of 1984-ish undertone. Right. And you look at things like these, like deep fakes,
mm-hmm.
you know, where you can just make a video of me using my face, my video, using my voice and making me say whatever it is you want to say. You know, I think there's mischief, certainly, that has happened and will continue to happen. The question is to what extent. So there's always, you know, there's always good and bad, right? You know, with these innovations, because they end up being in the hands of humans who are capable of both incredible acts of goodness and horrible acts of evil.
You know, there was a show, and you led in to like my next set of question, that was about Geoffrey Hinton. He was the godfather of AI. And it was on October 8th. He was interviewed on 60 Minutes, and he said that one of the ways in which systems might escape control is by writing their own computer code to modify themselves. This is what you had just alluded to earlier. He said, and that's something we need to seriously worry about. He used to work for Google. And according to him, you know, this concern about how AI, the text to image and generation tools, it can lead to more fake or fraudulent content being created. And how can the average person not, they won't be able to tell what is true and what is not true. I think that there's a lot of truth to that. And this guy is saying, hey, I wish, he literally said that on the show on 60 Minutes. I wish I had never invented this, because he sees it as something that could take humanity down.
Yeah, I know it sounds a sort of Oppenheimer-ish view of AI. Well, I've played around a little bit with AI, but just because, you know, just to
it's there.
See what it's like, right? It's there. And, you know, I one of my forecast publications a few quarters ago, I did a whole AI thing. I said, well, let's find out if I'm getting replaced. I'm going to ask AI these questions about the economy. Mm-hmm. And I did that. And it was, you know, some of it was okay. Some of it was so-so. But the one thing that impressed me thus far that I've seen AI do that kind of relates to this whole situation is asking it to write computer code. Like, you know, ChatGPT or whatever, you know, my little AI, write me a script that in Python will do this particular set of statistical analyses on this particular set of data. And it wrote, this was a video of somebody else asking it, but it wrote flawless code. I mean, it was just like perfect. Like you could just copy that code and it did exactly what the person verbally prompted AI to do. So, I mean, it could change, you know, the software entirely, where you just, you know, speak, analyze this for me, instead of having to know SAS or, you know, SPSS or any of these statistical packages that, you know, you would have to do manually today. If you could just ask the question and then it writes and executes what, you know, you need to do. You know, I can see that being, you know, again, a useful thing. For someone that's building a program or doing analysis, it makes them more efficient that they don't have to type out that code hand by hand and make typos and, you know, again, increases their productivity. I mean, the genie's out of the bottle, as they say. So exactly. I don't, you know, he can lament the fact that I never should have done it. But, you know, as a society and as, you know, as the human race has to decide to what extent this can, you know, it's now, you know, well, maybe if the atomic bomb had never been invented, that's one thing. But, you know, we've come to an agreement here after seeing it being used that we don't want to see this happen anymore, that this is horrific. And so, you know, it didn't just, you know, Oppenheimer just didn't lead to people casually tossing atomic bombs every time there was a conflict or disagreement. You know, we could probably arrive, you know, at a similar sort of agreement when it comes to AI. You know, I don't know, you know, what the mutually assured destruction of AI looks like, but I don't think anybody wants us to be, you know, overtaken by our robot, you know, masters and put into pods like we're living the Matrix.
Yeah, we're in WALL-E. We're sitting in little dumpling people in little chairs.
Well, yeah, I mean, well, we're getting there. Mainly because of our the food that we eat in this country and lack of exercise. But I don't know.
Yeah.
If I had a levitating lazy boy, if I could buy one, I'd get one. No lie.
Yeah, that would be a fun thing to have. That becomes your own like amusement park type of a ride, I guess. Yeah, I could see that happening. Well, I think that you're one of the more balanced people probably in economics, because I think that you always look at things as checks and balances. And if we go too far over, you know, then, yeah, there's a consequence. There's always a consequence, good or bad, right, with anything we do.
Well, I mean, sure. I mean, every, you know, every decision, you know, every choice you make, there's something that you didn't do.
That's right.
So there's, we call that an opportunity cost.
Mm-hmm.
You know, I chose to be on this podcast for an hour. That meant I couldn't, you know, spend an hour, you know, watching Netflix.
Yep.
Or working on my next forecast. So every choice involves a cost. And you know, that's really fundamental to economics as well.
Yep. And I don't think people think about that. So that leads into like my last question, next to last. What is the best mentoring advice that you would want to share with our listeners about the future in economics? What do you, I almost think like how you just finished, there is an opportunity cost with every choice. It's like, that is sound wisdom there. But I don't think people think that way.
No. And, you know, some of this is speaking as a parent, as much as an economist, you know, the future is, I'm in the business of making predictions. And so I understand how precarious and in some ways ridiculous it is to try to predict what's going to happen in the economy in 5 years from now. You know, specific predictions. The same thing's true. People in Florida know that when they look at hurricane maps. I know that when I see these, you know, gloom and doom climate predictions. I know this is just folly. You know, these predictions are based on these models that are just inherently flawed. And so when it comes like to individuals, you know, you can't see your future. I mean, it is obscured in a mist that, you know what are the kids doing these days? Tarot cards, no astrological readings is going to reveal to you. And you know, and you take one step into that future, it's not your final step. You have no idea where that first stone is ultimately going to lead you to. And so, you know, working with younger people and they're graduating and they're leaving college, and it's a stressful, I mean, that's a stressful transition in life. You know, disappointed about this job that I got, or it's not the one that I wanted. And I, you know, I'm just, you know, that's not your end game. That's not what you're going to do the rest of your life. That's just your first step. And you have no idea where that's going to take you. And anyway, you can do any job for a period of time, no matter how much you don't like it, as long as you know that it's not forever. Mm-hmm. Right? You're like, okay, oh, this job's the worst, but in 2 years, I'm going to do X, Y, and Z. All right. Get what you can out of that 2 years, and there's always something. I mean, even in the worst jobs I've had in my life, the jobs that I just despised, I took something away, whether it was just my personal growth or how to deal with these adverse situations when they come up again. So I think that's, you can't get, yeah, we're in such a, instant gratification world, right? You just want everything in the TikTok video, and it's just going to come at you, and it's easy and it's fast, and it's not.
Mm-hmm.
None of it is. None of it is. And so I think, people that are starting off in careers, and today, my grandfather, they called them mill hunkies, immigrants from that part of Europe that worked in steel mills. Yeah, they worked in that mill when they got out of high school, and they worked till they retired, that same place.
Mm-hmm.
They got a fixed benefit pension. They got a little gold tie clasp, and that was that. Those days are gone. You know, people entering the workforce now may change jobs 30, 40 times.
It's true.
They may entirely change careers. I mean, our children's, when they were younger, the pediatrician started off as a mechanical engineer.
Really?
And 10 years into his career, decided to go to medical school. I mean, who could predict that kind of swing? Nobody, and certainly not him. And, I think that's important. You just have to take each step and take what you can from that experience and move from there. Nothing's forever.
That is true. That is sound advice there too. So how can our listeners contact you? Website, social channels. What I put on that I put on here is your Twitter. You've got Twitter. We gave your personal LinkedIn, and then also your UCF Economics website, the big website, not the page.
Is it the link to the Institute for Economic Forecasting?
It is.
That's the important one. Yeah, that's it. I'm sort of like a bird without a beak on Twitter. I'm not chirping all that much, but I do have an account. And I know I'm not that big. I'm not. They want me to be better at social media, but I'm not particularly good.
I think it's okay if we're not, because we can still fly under the grid, and less.
I hope so. I still think they're watching me. I know my phone's listening to me right now.
It's always listening. It's always watching. It's always listening.
Yes.
That is it. Well, I want to thank you so much for being here, and thank you for the gift of your time that you could have been doing watching Netflix. So I am honored to have.
Yes, I heard a cost to be here.
So anyway, you take care, and I look forward to seeing you at your next event.
Thank you very much.
Thank you to our sponsor, Cat 5 Studios. Our video editor is Max Stein. Our music is by Sophie Lloyd. Visit www.e4c.tech to learn how you can recruit, assess, and improve employee learning and your company culture through DEI skills, hiring, and learning. Become an E4C member today. Mention you listen to the show, and you may get the chance to become a guest on the Intern Whisperer podcast. You can support the Intern Whisperer by sharing, commenting, liking, and subscribing on YouTube or your favorite podcast streaming apps.